talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
It started out with blasting Russia as being a world threat, and it ended with the same. Add to it more military aid, NATO's expansion, along with additional troops and new members. This time around, China was added to the list of being a threat. In this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at how the U.S.-led NATO preaches safety, but is endangering the world through its militaristic approach. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of the Spotlight. Author and commentator John Stepling joins us from Inderøy, Norway. Also joining us is journalist and political analyst Elijah Magnier, who joins us from Marseille in France.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Let me first start with you, John Stepling. When you take a look at this summit, which in many regards is a U.S.-led NATO gathering, what are we looking at when it comes to what it really spelled out? Was there anything new in that, except for the fact that it added China to a list of possible threats to the world?
I mean, they said China out loud, but everybody knew China was already on the list of sort of targets. you have to understand, I think, and it's almost difficult to believe in a sense, but the delusional level at which American foreign policy operates, and the real crux of this conflict is NATO expansion, of course, the eastward expansion of NATO. Back when James Baker was Secretary of State, you know, he promised to Gorbachev NATO would not expand one inch eastward. I think at that time there were 17 countries in NATO. Today there are 30, because they promptly broke that promise, and in 91, in 2004, 2007, they kept expanding. Poland, Hungary, Czech Republic, Slovakia, etc. And then, the real sort of the red line was Ukraine and Georgia. And, you know, even commentators and political analysts on the right and conservatives like Robert Gates, former Secretary of Defense, in his memoirs in 2014, at the very end of the book, he says, Ukraine and Georgia, the idea of them as candidates for NATO inclusion was reckless overreach. Even people like Henry Kissinger, George Kennan, when these are people that are warning it's a bad idea, I mean, you know, you wonder what's going on in the heads of people at the Biden administration. But the U.S. desperately needs a long, protracted war. It's an economic imperative, in a sense. I mean, the U.S. has to have a villain. They have to sell armaments. They have to create conflicts. And right. And when Putin took power in 2000, remember, he actively wanted to join NATO. And everybody in the European Union saw that as, you know, quite possibly a good idea, mm-hmm. until the United States told them, no, that's a terrible idea, because sure. the U.S. had long-term plans.
Let's take some of the fluff out of this whole summit's purpose, if we can, Elijah Magnier, through the lens that I'm about to paint a picture of. And I'd like to find out from you if this is an accurate reading of it. Because when you take a look at it, they come out and they make this show of how they, what do they call it, a new force model, a new strategic blueprint. And then when you take a look at it, it's really reinventing Russia as a threat again, almost, except for the fact, like as I said, they've added China to that list. But are they doing that, presenting Russia as a threat, perhaps more forcefully, in order to make sure that there is a unity between the members to act out against Russia?
Exactly. Well, if we remember in 2018, President Emmanuel Macron of France said NATO is in coma, is dead brain. And he called for the formation of a new European army. What President Joe Biden has managed to do is to take away this idea of having a European army and change it into a NATO army by increasing the number of intervention force from 40,000 to 300,000. That's a big achievement for the U.S. administration. In fact, the aim is has multiple purposes in this summit in Madrid. First, to bring Europe together as one bloc with the U.S. Second, because Europe is not really in harmony with each other between the Eastern Europe and the Western Europe, and that the difference is even increasing further. So Biden wants to really have one command, that is the U.S. command, and bring the differences between the East and Western Europe under one leadership, and that he has managed to do. And third, consider Russia from 2010 being a strategic ally to becoming a strategic enemy. That's a huge change. But the aim is not really only Russia, it is China. And the U.S. fears, very concerned about China's excess of wealth, rapid military modernization, and leadership position in Asia, Middle East, and Europe. So the summit in Madrid has multiple objectives and goals that were achieved by the U.S., and the European continent is happy with it, even if it is dragged under the U.S. and paying the consequences.
I can't figure how that's going to happen if we were going to take a look at the big picture here, John Stepling. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong. This is, okay, let's take a look at what Joe Biden has said. He has said that this war, I don't know how it's going to end, he said, but it will not end with Russia defeating defeating Ukraine, that is. So there you have that. You have Jens Stoltenberg has said that there's only a diplomatic solution to this at the table. But at the same time, Ukraine has to have the upper hand when it comes to its military posture on the ground. To me, that all sounds like this war is going to continue.
Yeah.
So where are we going to come in with NATO, or where are they going to come in terms of trying to now get all these countries to go after China? I mean, in terms of the EU, China was its number one trading partner just a few years ago.
Yeah. No, the U.S. absolutely. I mean, look, the U.S. has worked aggressively and feverishly to make sure there has been no diplomatic solution to this from the beginning, from day one. As soon as Zelensky would utter anything of a conciliatory nature, they would get another couple billion dollars in weapons shipped off immediately. This has been a long-term goal, though, of the neocon foreign policy contingency, and they hold very, very powerful positions again. The RAND Corporation published a paper that now is somewhat famous just a few years ago called Overextending Russia, How to Unbalance and Overextend Russia, something to that effect. It's available online. It spells out exactly what is taking place, that the idea is to provoke Russia into an armed conflict with Ukraine, overextend them, bleed them dry, turn it into another kind of Vietnam for Russia, which was the plan, of course, with Afghanistan way back. And this is the final chapter of that is regime change in Moscow. Now, what isn't said in that paper, but which is obvious, is that the next step after regime change in Moscow is regime change in Beijing. You know, these are insane ideas, of course, and the U.S., you know, what level of unreality they live in terms of their appraisals of relative power, I don't know. But the sanctions and all the actions so forth are already backfiring. I mean, the United States is suffering food shortages, the supply routes are interrupted, supply chains are interrupted. We're seeing increased homelessness and despair, desperation. Gas prices are through the roof. There's huge inflation in building materials and so forth. So the U.S. is suffering far more than Russia is from any of this. But this speaks to the fear the U.S. has of a shift in power globally, that we're, you know, the BRICS agreement, that we're seeing, you know, India, China, Russia, Iran, South America, forming alliances, and the U.S. is left out of this because nobody wants anything to do with the U.S.
Sure.
And they haven't for quite some time. And I think the U.S. is very slow to somehow recognize this. So they resort to their usual tactics of bullying and this sort of saber rattling.
Let's take a look about this idea of the unity that they are so keen on repeating out loudly, especially the U.S. president. And they say, you know, we have to keep the pressure on Russia. We have to make sure the sanctions are there. We have to make sure that we cut the revenues while we can. Well, statistics have come out saying that Russia earned 93 billion euros in revenues from fossil fuel exports in the first 100 days of the war. Well, at this point, we've passed that 100 days. Elijah Magnier, who do you think was this major buyer? The EU, 62% of this, worth approximately 57 billion euros. How is it then that they talk about exerting pressure on Russia when you have the EU being its number one importer of the fossil fuels?
Many European nations has decided to reduce their dependency on the Russian gas and oil. And they've started, France said they will reopen their coal factories, and they will depend for the electricity on coal. And they will start next winter is going to be very harsh on Germany and France particularly, and the rest of Europe. So who is providing this money? Mainly Europe, because it's still buying the Russian gas and cannot be independent for the next year or two, and still paying it for the higher price, because the price of oil has moved from being on $70 a barrel to between 113 today to 120. That difference brought a lot of money to Russia. Moreover, Russia is also selling to India and China, that both are very happy to receive this gas. And also there's another mockery in Europe, that Poland declared that it's no longer receiving the Russian gas, but suddenly Germany is pumping five times more from Russia than usual, because it's taking the gas from Russia and giving it also to Poland. So this masquerade is very well known, but Europe has decided and has selected its camp, and its camp is to pay the price. The population will pay the price. The inflation is between 8 to 10%, and it's going to go ahead with being totally with the U.S., with the U.S. objective, and has selected to be with the Americans against their own interests. That selection, that is not going to change for the next 10 years.
Yeah, sure. Well, forget about trying to reduce climate change. Forget about all those plans, I guess, if you have these type of buying going on. Okay, John Stepling, you kind of painted the world for us when you talked about BRICS. And when I say that, I'm talking about trying to break down the world in terms of who's allied with whom. If you have the BRICS countries, if you're looking at Latin America, where you have most of those countries, if not all at this point, having leftist politicians who are leaning towards the East, somewhat trying to push back against, I guess, the West that has failed them in terms of their economic models, And then Africa, where the U.S. is on the back foot, not really to have penetrated it as much as China has. And then you have West Asia, or as it's called, Middle East, where many of the countries are moving to the East, Iran included. Even Saudi Arabia is sitting on the fence, so to speak. We'll find out how this trip by Biden works out. Then are we looking at a world that really the U.S. and its European partners are in the minority when it comes to the numbers, and therefore economically then that would mean that they're inferior towards the rest of the world?
Well, I think they are fearful, but you know, the so-called pink tide in Latin America, I think, rattled the establishment in Washington. They had not expected that. You remember they tried to orchestrate a coup in Bolivia. Well, they did, but it ultimately failed. They constantly are trying to undermine Maduro in Venezuela, and there's a lot of pressure against these leftist governments. But it's always failing at this point. The U.S. has made a huge pivot. It began with Obama, but they pivoted to Africa. They increased spending for AFRICOM enormously. They just appointed a new, the first black Marine general, four-star general, to oversee AFRICOM. Africa looms as very important to the U.S. They need the raw materials and so forth that are there. They are home to huge mining interests in Africa that they want to protect. So we're seeing a strange economic restructuring going on. And this is, you know, the backdrop to this, of course, is the so-called Great Reset, the World Economic Forum, Klaus Schwab and all these people.
Right.
And you can't ignore how that's factoring into this. But I think that if you took the temperature of the rest of the world outside of the EU, it is overwhelmingly in support of Russia. Nobody is fooled by the theatrics of this summit in Madrid, except apparently the leadership in Europe. But you know, you saw very quickly Finland and Sweden wanting to join NATO because suddenly Russia is being painted as an imminent existential threat. Why anybody thinks, you know, Russia would invade Sweden is beyond me. But
right.
but that's the level at which the rhetoric works in white Europe. But for the rest of the world, I think this narrative doesn't play nearly as well. And this has to be something the U.S. is worried about. It has to be. And I think it accounts for a lot of the aggressive tone of the Biden administration.
Well, the U.S. has not figured out what's going to happen with Ukraine yet. I mean, another tranche of military aid to the tune of $850 million, I believe, is the latest, which comes out and puts that over $5 billion, close to six, if I'm not mistaken. Or maybe it has reached $6 billion. And what many people don't actually realize is the £2 billion that that the UK has actually added. So that's, $9 billion at this point? What we're looking at, Elijah Magnier, when it comes to this military assistance, is there's not a reality check here, because the facts on the ground are speaking in Russia's favor based on what's happening on the ground. What kind of game plan is there by pumping all this money when Ukraine is backtracking? I mean, and that's not the way they obviously describe it. So what is going on there?
Well, there is a reality from the Western point of view. And this reality is to continue fighting Russia as to the last Ukrainian, as long as Ukraine is happy to do the job on behalf of the U.S. So this is why the Americans have decided to support Ukraine with $53 billion and ship all the weapons possible that they can send to Ukraine, as long as the Ukrainian continue fighting, losing, but continue fighting. So Ukraine said that they need at least $5 billion a month to pay the salary and to kill, and they need more weapons. What's happening is irrelevant if Ukraine is losing territory, which it is, because Donetsk more or less is almost free now, and Lugansk, sorry, and then the move is to take the rest of Donbass.
Exactly.
So that's irrelevant for the Americans, because they keep engaging Russia on the ground. They keep demonizing Russia They keep bringing the European all together under the thumb of the U.S. That's an achievement for the U.S. This is why Ukraine already chose its camp and can no longer change to stop the war unless dictated by the Americans.
Well, the fact of the matter is, when you have a summit that puts China on a list John Stepling, and puts it almost in the same category as Russia, I mean, we're looking at how the world is suffering, not because solely because of what's happening with the Ukraine conflict, but because of what Russia represents in terms of commodities and things like fertilizers also that is not highlighted. I mean, God save us if something is going to happen with China. You know, so for how much, how realistic is what NATO is preaching through the U.S. in terms of going after China?
Well, I mean, it's utterly unrealistic. But, you know, a lot of people have predicted this. I mean, John Pilger made a short film, a very good film, The Looming Coming War with China, some title like that. That's very good. I mean, he said this 10 years ago. The U.S. have been building bases in the South China Sea for the last 10 years, naval bases throughout the region. They've increased troops in South Korea, Japan. All of this was targeting China. They continue to make sort of insulting and bellicose remarks about Taiwan that, you know, China just sort of endures and ignores because there's nothing backing it up. The U.S. economy is entirely dependent on war. I mean, those 900 military bases we always speak about around the world are the bedrock of the U.S. economy. It is what, you know, the U.S. does and sells. And if you look at China and Russia, they only have together something like five bases outside their borders. So we're seeing a different level of reality here. But China has enormous economic power, obviously. Russia has more economic power, I think, than the U.S. realized. If you read the Western press, though, this is not the story that you hear. And if you read even the New York Times, Washington Post, you would think Ukraine is winning this conflict. It's extraordinary. The first phase of this military incursion by Russia is essentially over. They, as your other guest said, they have liberated the Donbass region for all intents and purposes.
Okay.
And Ukraine is running out of soldiers. They're not running out of weapons, but they are running out of soldiers.
All right. So one thing not talked about here, which I was going to draw this to a close, Elijah Magnier, is how we don't hear much about China's military capabilities. But I believe that China has done quite a lot in terms of trying to expand its capacities in one way or another within the military arena, perhaps even nuclear expansion and other areas. Do you think that there is a matchup there when you have not just China, but Russia and other countries, if the goal is to move ultimately to provoke China and then move on and confront China militarily?
I don't think China is interested in confronting the U.S. militarily. The United States has created an international rule and order to its liking, and that has started since the Second World War. And the U.S. believes that China, along with Russia, BRICS, Iran, are challenging this order. But China has built a wall to stay within it, but not to go and conquer other countries. China is interested in offering a different model than the U.S., than the unilateral hegemony of the world. This is why China is creating a fear in the U.S., because it's seeking for developing other countries to make them, to empower them and make them more independent and detach themselves from the U.S. This is what the Americans are afraid, and there is a fear in Washington that they believe either us or them, while China believes us and them. There is a space for everybody, and President Xi Jinping has become confident that China's economic system and governance model is enough to be in the international affair and arena without the need to be in a war with the U.S. or with any other country. However, China is supporting Russia here, and together they make a formidable adversary to the U.S. to discourage the U.S. from starting a war against China, but not to provoke the U.S. The provocation comes always from the U.S. side, that feared threatened because it has started an inevitable decline. This is why China created fear for its power in wealth and in development technology. I mean, the Chinese have 5G that the U.S. haven't reached, so they can't accuse Chinese from copying everything. However, China is making carrier, jet carrier. They're making one every 6 months or a year. But the U.S. needs several years. So there's a development that creates a real fear in the U.S.
Thank you. Sorry to jump in. We're fresh out of time. Elijah Magnier there, journalist and political analyst John Stepling. Thank you, author and commentator. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Vitahue and the team, it's goodbye.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us. أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Dear listeners, hello everyone. Welcome to another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and in this edition, we will try to have a closer look at the 25th chapter, Surah Al-Furqan. First, let's just listen to the verses we're going to talk about in this program, and we'll be back shortly. So stay with us.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
قُلْ مَا يَعْبَأُ بِكُمْ رَبِّي لَوْلَا دُعَاؤُكُمْ فَقَدْ كَذَّبْتُمْ فَسَوْفَ يَكُونُ لِزَامًا
Say, what would my Lord care for you if not for your supplication? For disbelievers have denied, so your denial is going to be adherent.
We have reached the last verse of chapter Furqan, The 77th verse. قُلْ مَا يَعْبَأُ بِكُمْ رَبِّي لَوْلَا دُعَاءُكُمْ Say, My Lord would not esteem you at all were it not for your prayer. فَقَدْ كَذَّبْتُمْ فَسَوْفَ يَكُونُ لِزَامَهُ But you indeed have belied the truth, and soon you shall be in the grip of the inevitable. This is the last verse of chapter Furqan. It is in fact the conclusion of all the discussions of Surah as well as the attributes of Ibadur Rahman which were mentioned in the previous verses. The Prophet ﷺ is addressed here. So the Quran says,
قل ما يعبأ بكم ربي لولا دعاؤكم. O Prophet, say to the disbelievers, My Lord would not esteem you at all were it not for your prayer unto him. The Arabic word يعبأ means weight and heaviness. The Quranic sentence ما يعبأ بكم ربي means that Allah does not value and weigh you unless you worship and unless you pray. Though there are many probabilities about the meaning of the word dua and prayer mentioned here, all of them have somehow approximately one root and source. Some say that it means to pray, some others say that it means faith, and some believe that it means worshipping in monotheism. Some also claim that it means thanking. Others say it means to call Allah at the time of difficulties and disasters. However, the root of them is faith and paying attention to Allah, which is the heart of servitude. Therefore, the verse implies that what makes one valuable and respected before Allah is having faith in Allah and His servitude. Anyway, the verse continues, فَقَدْ كَذَّبْتُمْ But you indeed have belied. فَسَوْفَ يَكُونُ لِزَامًا And soon you shall be in the grip. It may be considered here that there is no coherency and relationship between the beginning part of the verse and the ending part, because it seems that there are two different sentences without any connections. But by some careful study, it gets clear that the main purpose is that formerly polytheists and pagans, you may remember, it was said that they denied the revelations of Allah and His prophets. And if these people do not return to Allah and do not worship Him, no value and respect they will have before Him, and the punishments of their denials will be certain. You may remember, they even mocked the religion and said, Mar Rahman, what is the Beneficent? And now here, as the conclusion of the whole chapter, they are addressed again. And they will be told that if you did not have prayer and worship, the Lord would not esteem you at all.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
word. In this series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
So, as you understood, this is the importance of supplication. In this regard, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam has said, praying turns away divine decree, though it has come down from heaven and is stabilized. This is so crucial that it is said about worshipping and praying, that the job that Allah, glorious the majestic, likes best on the earth is praying, and the best worship is modesty and chastity. Now, some might claim that this is Allah, the creator, the absolute cause we're calling, and he knows everything, so why should we somehow bother ourselves to call out to him, to ask him our demands? Allah knows our needs and our demands. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam says, Allah knows what you want from him, but he likes that you retell your needs to him. Because it seems that it is for our own sake to have someone to refer to. And praying is the heal of every malady, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam said. So it will cure some of the diseases we might not be aware of. Anyway, what we said is that between the beginning part and the ending part of this verse, there is connection. And one of the evidences that confirmed this commentary is a tradition from Imam Baqir alayhi salam, who was asked whether too much recitation of the Holy Quran is preferred or too much praying. He answered that too much praying is best. And then Imam alayhi salam recited this verse. We know that praying is much considered important in the verses of the Holy Quran and also Islamic traditions, and one of its examples was this verse. But praying has got different conditions. To know the one whom we are calling, to purify our heart and soul before we ask him. Another important condition is to make him that we want to ask something from, to make him happy and contented, because without happiness of him, fulfillment of demand is unlikely. And we must know that if we want to ask something from Almighty Allah, we must use all of our powers and potentialities to try our best and then to ask Allah something beyond it. And these are some of the important etiquettes and prerequisites of supplication. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us in this program. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things always worked for me. Worry ends when faith begins.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Allah,
چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا، ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Allahu ya Allah subhanallah. Allahu ya Allah walhamdulillah. Allahu wa la ilaha
The noble Prophet of Islam, peace be upon him and his family, himself behaved with the people like one of them. He was like one of the rest of the people. He was one of them. He neither had a governor's resistance nor in social gatherings would he sit at the top and the people below. These issues were not of consideration at all. some of the Arabs who would come from other regions and enter the mosques would see the Prophet seated with the rest such that it would be difficult for them to identify who the Prophet was from among the people who were seated and who were his companions. They would ask who among them the Prophet was.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome to the program Spring of Truth from IRB English Radio. In this program, we talk about the viewpoints of Imam Khomeini in regards to the Quran. In one of his speeches, Imam Khomeini has said that, "My dear youth, on whom I pin my hope, hold the Quran in one hand and take up arms in the other, and defend your honor and prestige in such a way as to remove from the enemies the power to think and plot against you." Imam Khomeini, in this part of his speech, is referring to a very, very important point, and that is that if someone is holding the Quran in his hand, and if he is following the Quran, then obviously he is taking away the power of thinking and plotting against themselves from their enemies. So they do not allow their enemies to plot anything against them. They do not allow their enemies to think about them. They will take this power from them. And we have seen this many times.
Ya Rabbana, salli ala Taha al-Nabi wa alihi, sallallahu alayhi.
The enemies of the Islamic Revolution, they have spent millions of dollars against the Islamic Revolution. We can see that how they spend money for ISIS, the terrorist groups, how they spend money on the hypocrites groups in the Islamic Revolution. But it was the guidance which was given by the supreme leader, when it was Imam Khomeini, when it is the supreme leader Ayatollah Khamenei, when we see both of them in their lives, we see that even when the enemies are spending a lot of money, billions and millions and trillions of dollars against a system, because this system is holding Quran in their hand. They're holding in with one hand the Quran, with the other hand they will take away something which they plot, and therefore the strategies of enemies are facing the failure. They are failing in front of this system, this Islamic Revolution. Why? Because, as Imam Khomeini has said, that this youth is holding Quran in their hand. They're following the teachings of the Quran. And since Quran is the book for the believers, it is the book of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and Allah has sent it for the guidance of the mu'mineen and believers, and muttaqin, those who God-fearing. Therefore, the victory is with these. And that's why in the Quran, Allah also says that, "Let it be known that the army of Allah is the victorious. The victory is for those who are with the Quran, and the victory is for the Quran for sure and for definitely. And the enemies of Quran will definitely face the failure."
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
سید امین عالمی، کابل.
شهان بات، ایندین ادمنستریت کشمیر.
Around the world with reporters.
British Premier League football team Tottenham Hotspurs have come under fire ahead of a pre-season friendly match. The fixture, pitting Tottenham against Italian side AS Roma, scheduled in Haifa on July the 30th, has been condemned as an attempt to normalise crimes against Palestinians by critics.
The fans, especially amongst whom are many people of Muslim background or of ethnic minorities, they will be big supporters of the Palestinians, but the team going out there is a slap in the face for them.
The London-based Human Rights Commission launched a letter campaign encouraging supporters to write to Tottenham and demand the club cancel the controversial fixture. Elsewhere, pro-Palestine supporters condemned the fixture online.
We have an epidemic of Russophobia in this country and across the whole of the West, but there is no similar attempt to hold Israel to account for its crimes. 74 years since Israel was created out of the ethnic cleansing of the Palestinians, people who are still refugees with no home to go to.
Israel has been recognised by Amnesty International as an apartheid regime. Their crimes have been well documented for many years. Just days prior to Tottenham announcing the fixture, international outrage was sparked over the slaying of Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akhileh.
Tottenham have so far not commented on any of the criticism, but they did announce last May that they were delighted with their planned tour of Israel. This suggests that perhaps Tottenham Hotspurs is not as concerned about human rights abuses as perhaps they should be. Robert Carter, London.
As hundreds of thousands of Muslims embark upon a pilgrimage to the Holy Kaaba in Mecca, they must enter a particular state of purification and sanctity known as the Ihram. In Arabic, Ihram means prohibition and a state of holiness.
Ihram and Miqat are like a runway for planes. If one wants to ascend, he'd better use this runway. You can't do it from anywhere else.
Ihram is an obligatory prerequisite to Hajj. Muslims stop at a designated station to perform the rituals associated with wearing Ihram. The stations of Miqat are the five prescribed places for Ihram, located at different directional quarters from the holy city of Mecca, Saudi Arabia. Pilgrims perform ablution and cleanse their bodies. Then they wear Ihram and make Niyat, the intention of performing Hajj. Men are required to wear two pieces of white cloth that are unadorned and plain. Women are not required to conform to a specific dress code, but have to dress modestly. It is crucial to ensure that the clothes are neat and tidy.
In addition to its facade, Hajj has an essence. We must find out the essence of the act of wearing ihram. This attire signifies the removal of any impurity or unclean aspect from our body and soul.
We wear ihram to abstain from sins we have committed in the past and get closer to God. After wearing ihram, Muslims are prohibited from a number of acts.
Ihram also resembles the shroud used to wrap dead bodies before they are buried. Therefore, it's a reminder of how death comes unannounced and does not discriminate between anyone.
There are different stages in Hajj that are like wake-up calls for us in our lives. Ihram reminds us of the afterlife and that our existence would not perish after death.
After cleansing their bodies and wearing ihram, Muslims get ready for the journey to the holy city of Mecca and they will visit Kaaba. Mahdi Abbasian, Medina.
A perfect storm is brewing for Italy's economy. Just as the country was beginning to see the light at the end of the tunnel after getting badly hurt during the pandemic, a combination of more unexpected shocks is threatening its stability. The energy crunch due to the Ukraine crisis, the subsequent energy price spikes and rising interest rates are threatening to put Italy's economy on the ropes.
Confidence has diminished considerably in Italy, with consumers and companies seeing a less positive future. Households are increasingly feeling the brunt of the inflation that has risen to nearly 7%, the highest level in over two decades.
Analysts are saying that Italy's economy could contract further if Russia, after reducing gas supply by 40%, decides to stop the flow of gas altogether. A total halt in supply could trigger company shutdowns and layoffs. Numerous protests have been staged across the country over the past weeks amidst growing skepticism toward the government. As the European Central Bank is expected to adopt higher interest rates to counter the Eurozone's growing inflation, conditions of living are expected to worsen in Italy and across the old continent. Many fear this deteriorating scenario is likely to lead to a hot autumn of protests. Max Civili, Rome.
The Iranian city of Sardasht in West Azerbaijan province is the third city after Japan's Hiroshima and Nagasaki, which became the target of weapons of mass destruction in the world. In June 1987, Iraqi warplanes dropped mustard gas bombs on Sardasht in two separate bombing runs on four residential areas. The gas attacks occurred during the Iraqi-imposed war on Iran, when Iraq frequently used chemical weapons against Iranian civilians and soldiers. According to official reports, out of 12,000 inhabitants of Sardasht, over 8,000 were chemically wounded, while 130 people died of the mustard gas attack.
After 3 decades, the city of Sardasht is still reeling from the consequences of Iraq's chemical bombardment, since many of the survivors still have to live with the long-term respiratory and even psychological effects of inhaling mustard gas used in the attack.
In April 2004, the Tehran Public Court found the government of the United States liable for the attacks through its support for the regime of Saddam Hussein. The U.S. government was ordered to pay $600 million in compensation to the victims.
The chemical attack survivors fell victim to some Western governments' inhumane policies. When Western companies gave Saddam's regime chemical materials and technology for production of chemical weapons, with the representatives of their government in the UN Security Council remaining silent, turning a blind eye to Saddam's chemical crimes and letting him continue using chemical weapons against combatants and civilians. The U.S. and its allies are the main perpetrator of this heinous crime.
Saddam's regime used chemical weapons against Iranian forces and civilians more than 300 times during the 8-year war, leading to the injury of more than 100,000 people, including thousands of civilians. Over 400 Western companies equipped Saddam with chemical and biological weapons. According to available documents, most of these companies belong to Germany, Britain, and France.
Despite the passage of 35 years from the Sardasht chemical bombings, still the families of victims urged the international community to bring the main perpetrators of the crimes to justice. But their call seemed to have fallen on deaf ears so far. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
It was the announcement years in the making. An opportunity for Scottish First Minister Nicola Sturgeon to lay out her party's vision for a Scotland free of Westminster control.
Presiding Officer, now is the time, at this critical moment in history, to debate and decide the future of our country. Now is the time to get Scotland on the right path, the path chosen by those who live here. Now is the time for independence.
For long-time pro-independence campaigners, the news was warmly greeted.
I think many people in Scotland are going to be very pleased. I mean, we haven't put up with a Boris Johnson government. Many things, of course, are devolved to the Scottish government, but many are not. And therefore, we still have inflicted on us a government we never voted for, a Conservative government. We don't vote Conservative, we get Conservative governments. And Boris Johnson is regarded as being a complete Etonian liability by people in Scotland. We want to escape.
Scots were promised a once-in-a-generation opportunity to vote for independence back in 2014, where the Yes movement narrowly missed out by 55.3% to 44.7%. Now, recent polls put the matter much more equally balanced with an almost 50-50 split.
Boris Johnson will not want to go down in history as the Conservative leader who spearheaded the breakup of the union. So Westminster will be doing all that it can to keep Scotland within the fold. But with such stark differences emerging between the devolved administration and London, well, the task of keeping the union intact is becoming more difficult than ever.
The response from London has been a familiar one, simply saying now is not the right time for a vote. But some ministers have been less diplomatic.
They lost the referendum, and instead of then saying, OK, hands up, let's try and see if there's a better way, let's try and better the people of Scotland's experience with public services, she's just banged on the same one-trick pony.
Recent political events across the union have presented a growing headache for the Conservatives, with unionists across the region losing ground. Aside from the legal battles ahead, the SNP also has to win the domestic argument. With a tough road ahead, the SNP says the Scottish people should have the right to determine their own future, a move London will attempt to thwart at every stage. Amina Taylor, London.
Afghan people affected by the earthquake in southeastern Afghanistan are grappling with dire situations. Hundreds of families are living in the open, out of fear that there may be further tremors.
For the sake of God, please help us survive this catastrophe. The earthquake has devastated our houses and livelihoods. We live outdoors. During the night, it rains very heavily. I'm afraid these harsh conditions will further harm my only surviving family members. In addition, we don't have enough food and cash.
In the meantime, the affected people in Paktika and Khost provinces say that the provided aid is not sufficient.
We thank the Afghan government and charities for assisting us with humanitarian aid, but they are not sufficient as thousands of our people in several districts have been affected by the deadly earthquake. There are a lot of children who are awaiting food and wounded people who are in dire need of medication. We ask them to scale up their assistance to our people, especially food, drinking water, and tents.
The Afghan health minister, in a press conference in Kabul on Monday, warned that the survivors of the earthquake are at risk of diseases, including mental problems.
This is very true that affected people are also exposed to getting sick. Some are getting mental or psychological illnesses because they have lost everything, including their loved ones. Some people, especially children, are at risk of malnourishment and other diseases. I call on the international community to help us stave off the disaster and create a safe situation for them to live on.
So far, the United Nations and several neighboring countries have rushed aid to the devastated areas, but helping thousands of victims remains a challenge for the foreign countries due to the U.S. restrictions imposed on the country following the Taliban's takeover of Afghanistan. Afghanistan has been facing multiple humanitarian crises in the past decades. The recent earthquake is a reminder that the war-torn country should not be forgotten by the global community. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
France's new parliament has been inaugurated, and many expect the next 5 years will be turbulent. President Emmanuel Macron was reprimanded at the ballot box, losing his absolute majority. He then failed to cobble together a coalition, leaving France with a so-called hung parliament. Each different bill will now have to find its own majority to become enacted, although since 2012, French presidents have often resorted to executive decrees to pass unpopular, austerity-minded legislation. Many also speculate that if Parliament doesn't work in his favor, that Macron could call for new elections in maybe a matter of months.
He's not going to be able to do anything to make any reform because it's going to be completely blocked between the extreme right wing and the Mélenchon team, which are completely opposite. And so I believe that not much is going to happen during the next 5 years, which will give rise to, you know, more extreme positions in the future.
The far-right national rally, led by Marine Le Pen, won a record 15% of seats. Islamophobia has already been obvious in France's judicial and presidential branches, and now it's widely present in their legislative branch.
We now have an assembly which better represents the range of public opinion. The president will stay in his assigned role of a sort of republican monarch. We'll see more debate, and that might produce more reforms.
A clear improvement is an increased number of working-class legislators, thanks to the NUPES leftist coalition, but even more so because of the national rally. Still, just 6% of parliamentarians are from the working class. Yeah.